Good evening. You never heard such a simple beginning from me, did you? And welcome to the first of a series that has been organized under the title The Bennington Seminars. The college and the art division would like to express their gratitude to the Graham Foundation for Advanced Studies in the Fine Arts of Chicago, Illinois, for making these seminars possible. We should also like to thank Mr. Kendall Landis and the Development Office in particular for handling some of the tackier aspects of getting this show off the ground. In all, there will be 9 such seminars, 3 a week on each Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of this and the following 2 weeks, and they will all take place on this campus here in Barnwan on each of the designated evenings at 8:30. At the very outset, it is already possible to say that these seminars are unique in one respect. The Bennington community has in effect been offered the unique privilege of participating in and perhaps contributing to a forthcoming book on art. For the entire proceedings, as you've seen, of these 9 evenings of discussion will be put on tape to assist, it is hoped, in the creation of this new study by our esteemed guest. It is probably this extracurricular aspect of these seminars, not to mention the extraordinary interest in them that has already preceded them, that has prompted the sort of introduction usually reserved for more formal occasions, such as that of a major lecture. A lecture has a public aspect that is denied the seminar, which might be described as a town meeting of ideas. Indeed, Mr. Greenberg is not here to lecture so much as he is to raise and to ask for a discussion of issues that he feels are pertinent to the history of art in general and the history of modernist art in particular. The minimum that is demanded of us, therefore, is not merely that we engage these issues, but that we engage Mr. Greenberg on them as well. At all times, the act of real critical probity is virtually a moral act. If, as Mr. Greenberg has maintained, the history of art is the history of quality, critical probity insists that culture and quality, at least culture that is not mere taste, are synonymous. Yet repeatedly today, this notion of quality and culture has not only been challenged by art, which proclaims itself beyond the framework of traditional criticism, it has become politicized as well. Quality, it seems, is an elitist concept. Consequently, there is a great deal to talk about, and these seminars could be important seminars. Probably this also accounts for the ritual which I have been asked to perform. As for the man who shall conduct these seminars, Clement Greenberg, he scarcely needs, as the saying goes, an introduction. He is well known at Bennington, having lectured here and conducted reviews of student work several times. His association with Bennington, in fact, goes back a number of years. He is, of course, the author of a book of the most influential essays in contemporary art, Art and Culture. If these essays did not shape the taste for the best art of our time, no art writing has done more to define the level at which the best art of our time performs. Inevitably, he has his critics, and I should judge Mr. Greenberg's importance by the compulsive virulence with which his detractors have attempted to discredit the sense of quality that he has defined in his writings during the past 30 years. Modernist art is said to be a radically changing and changeable art, but somehow Mr. Greenberg has so far managed to keep pace with it. To my mind, he is easily the most important art critic since Roger Fry. Mr. Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Tellum. It's always a pleasure to be back at Bennington. And I don't think I should expatiate why, but it's funny what a professional atmosphere a girls' college, or what once used to be a girls' college, can generate. And without necessarily having that so many professionals around. And I think that for that reason, as well as for many personal ones, I feel I can let go at Bennington as I can in few other places. Now, this job is a real challenge to me. It's Mr. Landis's idea. He got me into it. Oh, yes, he did. And I don't know exactly where I'll be going, or where we'll be going in later seminars. It, in some part, depends on you, too. This is not a solo performance. And for me, it's altogether an untried venture. And I think it's altogether an untried venture because I feel that art and aesthetics, and I want to start with aesthetics, have not been discussed properly over the last 150 years. I don't propose that we here will cast a new and blinding light on the question. But I do think we're at this moment in a particularly advantageous position to do something a little bit new because of what we've learned from contemporary art over the last 10 years. I happen to feel it's made clear certain general truths about art that no philosopher of aesthetics could have discovered before. As Mr. Tillum said, it's quality that I'm interested in. And the so-called far-out art of the last 10 years has put the question of quality on the table as never before. And as I think, shown, revealed amazing things about how quality in art makes itself felt. Now, in I don't want to sound fashionably Wittgensteinian. I know Wittgenstein's a very okay name today, and I'm not competent to criticize him, but he had hold of, as I see it, one part of the truth, probably more, when he said, let's find out how we talk about things, and maybe we'll find out what we really think of things, how we act on what we think rather than what we think we ought to think. Now, making clear the limits of what you can say about art has more than theoretical usefulness. I think it's useful not only to the art lover and not only to the art critic. It's useful, it could be useful to the artist himself. The clearing away of irrelevancies, fetishes, dogmas, the clearing away of highfalutinous, irresponsible rhetoric, inflated language, melodrama, all the verbal excrescences that have come to accompany modernist art in particular, but not just modernist art. I think that pertinent thinking and talking about art are much simpler, or should be much simpler, and much directer than they usually are. And even the talking and thinking about aesthetics, the discipline known as aesthetics, which may not be that simple to start with, needn't be that top-heavy or highfalutin. Well, I said limits. One of the first things we have to do in approaching art is appreciate the fact that art is something recognizable but not satisfactorily definable or even describable. They're approximations, they're stabs, circumlocutions that have to do with the effect of art, but hardly graze what goes on in the actual creation of art or in its actual appreciation. Unlike things that have meanings which can be put into words, works of art are intuited or experienced or perceived in a way like that in which sense qualities, colors, sounds, touchings, smells, and tastes are. These primary things, these primary perceptions, are inexplicable and indescribable. You can talk about wavelengths of light and wavelengths of sound. You may talk about other forms of measurement. You may be able to tell, prescribe how sounds, colors, certain quality are to be produced. But you can't describe or define their effect, their feeling. Now, it's analogous in this respect with art. Works of art are describable and even measurable in many ways, but not as art qua art, not in their action or effect strictly as art. Indefinability, indescribability, belongs to all things that contain their own purpose, things that are ends in themselves, and not necessarily means to or indicators of something else. And this applies to human beings, and applies to love and moral behavior. Ends like happiness, it even applies to play. Like these, art is an ultimate value. That is, the experience of art is an ultimate value. Something we go to for the sake of the experience alone, and of which we ask nothing more than that so-called non-referential experience. It's not an experience to be figured out or unraveled. Art is there for its own sake. Now, art for art's sake is a notion that's been in bad odor lately, but it holds all the same. It's there, and it holds fast. All we have to do is remember that while art is an ultimate value, insofar as it's inherently valuable, it's an ultimate value in itself, it's not a supreme value. It's a subordinate value as against the weal and woe of human beings, as against the happiness and suffering of any single human being. But all the same, this doesn't mean that when we occupy ourselves with art, art isn't valuable, doesn't remain valuable in and for itself, and not for something else. And trying to justify art by assigning it a purpose outside or beyond itself is one of the main causes, though far from being the only one, of the obfuscation of all the misleading, irrelevant, and hampering talk and activity about art. In our Western culture, it's very hard to put up with the notion of things valuable entirely in themselves, even though we may act on that notion much more often than we realize. And I think that Western civilization, for all that's wrong with it, happens to treat human beings, in theory anyhow, as ultimate ends to a greater extent than any other civilization does. The aesthetic, as an end in itself, seems to be much more familiar, much more taken for granted among Chinese, Japanese, Greco-Romans, and other exotic peoples. Who seem also, and this is seeming, I may not know what I'm talking about here, seem also to have granted less absolute ultimate value to the human person and personality. But it makes no difference. If we're talking about art, we're talking about art as an end in itself. If we're dealing with art, it's an end in itself. There's simply no getting around that. Well, there's a kind of convergence here. The inscrutability of something like primary perception, perception of colors, sounds, tastes, smells, touches, and the inscrutability of ultimate ends like art and like the human personality, these different inscrutabilities come together to compound the difficulty of talking about art in a discursive, analytic, ratiocinative way. And the fact is, we don't know. We're not able to describe, define, place, discriminate with anywhere near satisfactory precision or useful precision what goes on inside the human mind when art's being made, or what goes on inside the human mind when art's being experienced. Uh, All we have to help us here is not, certainly not discursive reasoning. All we have is something I can only call insight, direct insight, and insights of such a nature that they can't be viably expressed we can know usefully enough what goes on when we add two and two, and we know it's going to come out as four, and we know pretty well what we're about when we infer from the fact that all men are mortal, and that Socrates is a man, that Socrates is mortal. And we know what we're about when we infer from the fact that there are clouds in the sky, that there's a pretty good chance if it's raining or snowing. And we know that the clouds have something to do with the rain or snow. It's in some part because we can't make safe inferences of this kind about art as art, about art as quality, that the talk and the writing about art amount at their best to guesses, stabs, approximations, surmises, not to conclusive or factual statements. And it's also because of this that the talk and the writing about art reach their best when they show, exhibit something of this tentativeness. Except with respect to one aspect of art, the relative value, worth, quality of particular works or items of art. That is, when it comes to value judgments, aesthetic verdicts, we need not be that tentative. We can tell when we like, and we can tell when we don't like a work of art, more often than not. The main point is to be able to report this truthfully, not only to other people, but to yourself. Now, I don't want to anticipate too much where I hope to lead the seminar tomorrow. And I think I've said enough to provoke questions and even opposition from many of you in the audience. And at this point, the seminar really begins. And there must be someone here who takes exception to something I've said. And let me say, after this grim beginning, and I always begin grim, let me say that you can't make a fool of yourself asking a question in this area. Too many people have already made fools of themselves for there to be any novelty in this respect. So, if you honestly feel a question, you honestly feel that you take exception to something I've said, or that I haven't made myself clear, please do speak up. Because as I said before, this is not a solo performance, and I don't intend to make it a monologue.
you mentioned that art for art's sake is the, I don't know whether you could call it an aesthetic, but anyway, the idea that you're using, or that you keep in mind. I don't take exception to that, but I wonder whether you might define it a bit more in relationship to what happened before the late 19th century, you see what I mean? Like, yeah. In reference to Renaissance and...
Yeah, before it became a slogan and before it became something conscious. Yeah, art was in the service of the church, it was in the service of the state, it was in the service of even in the service of politics, and it has been since. Well, we notice that the best art of the past was somehow made with the intention of making good art primarily, that the a religious theme, ceremonial theme, doctrinal theme, political theme, let's say the glorification of the celebration of a ruler or powerful person became pretext. And we already notice, even before Vasari, that artists are praised not for even their religious feeling. They're praised for the excellence of their art. And hardly anything else. We have it right there in the discourse about art. And we also say, the artist's conscious intention doesn't consciously operate, for the most part. Giotto, painted to celebrate the life of Jesus. But we can see from the results that he painted just as much to produce good pictures, even though we can we might feel, well, we're projecting our own experience of his pictures in back into his motives. If we knew more about what went on in the human consciousness when art was made, when art is being made, we could answer your question and with less surmise.
I want to ask a question. In the reading, first I read Croce. Is that how you say his name?
Yes, that's right.
And then I read Harold Osborne, and he describes Croce's philosophy as being romantic, and he describes the philosophy that he adheres to as being post-romantic. And he brings in some idea about the expressive quality of the work. Could you explain that a little?
I don't happen to agree with Mr. Osborne that much as I respect his book. So I would rather not try to explain Mr. Osborne himself. Now we get in terms like expressiveness and so forth, where in the area I call approximations, stabs and all that, guesses at art. And I would prefer just to leave that kind of question aside for the moment. It's a verbal question, primarily in any case. You know, what do we mean by expressiveness? And we can get on to that and go around. All good art is expressive. It couldn't be good unless it were. Just as all good art is organized. Just as all good art has form. As a matter of fact, bad art, there's no such thing as formless art. Actually, there's no such thing as disorganized art. That's just badly organized art. An art that has bad form. See, and we can go around with these words, and it's these words I want to not get ourselves hung up on.
Well, I'm glad you told me that, because I won't continue. I was a little alarmed at the book, actually, because I had been going along reading everything and, you know, feeling that I was in the right area, and then I hit this, and he was going into the whole thing about expressive art being somehow romantic and, old-fashioned.
Oh, really? I don't think he actually meant that.
No,
not Osborne. I don't think...
No, but he says it's romantic and that he's post-romantic, and I wondered what it was he was trying to say.
I don't pay attention to labels like that myself. I don't think there's any use in paying too much attention to them. Mr. Osborne wrote, in my opinion, a very good book. I think at certain points, he bogs down just as I do too. God knows I don't think I'm as good as he is. But you will bog down writing on aesthetics in certain places.
When you were setting out your remarks in the beginning, you said that when art's being made to experience, the only way that can be expressed is insight. And then you went on to give examples of from logic, like 2 and 2 equals 4. And other like inductive arguments that whose validity it comes from certain rules that are established, rules of thought. And then you said that art can't be described as conclusively, but the best descriptions can only show the tentativeness of art in contrast to those kinds of descriptions.
The best descriptions can only be tentative, not that art itself is tentative.
Judgments and aesthetic verdicts can be non-tentative, and I was wondering what qualifies those judgments as being non-tentative. Are there some rules, for instance, that would enable judgments of quality to have the assurance of inductive statements like the ones 2 and 2?
That's a damn good question. Are you studying philosophy?
Yes.
Huh? That's a damn good question. It anticipates the next seminar. Here, the question of direct insight comes in. It's almost the way Descartes put it. He said, how do I know I exist? He said, well, I know. Therefore, I know I exist. I know some things. I mean, I'm conscious. That's the way, and therefore I know I exist. Your reaction to a work of art is simply there, even though it may be one of inattention, indifference. It's there. Now, I'm anticipating myself. I wanted to get on that tomorrow night. But suffice it to say for the moment, I hope, you have this immediate take of your own take. Mm-hmm. And that's a question all in itself, since people are in the habit of lying to themselves on the influence of culture about all sorts of things that happen to them. You know? Thinking that certain things happen to them because that's what's supposed to happen to them when something else has actually happened to them, but preferring to think that certain things have happened to them because that's already written about in books, or it's culturally respectable, or it's provided for, when actually what's happening to them hasn't a prescribed cultural category. Now, Aesthetic verdicts are the warp and woof of aesthetic experience. You can't have aesthetic experience without having a verdict, even if it's only the one that consists in being bored, which is a negative verdict. You can't avoid these verdicts. That's why I say they're not tentative, any more than the fact of your experience. But I prefer to save that topic for the next seminar. Now, I'm afraid this is going to happen again and again, that I'm going to be anticipated by the sharp minds present who see where the implications of what is said are leading. And one of the reasons I want to slow it up is I think I'll be able to explain myself better if we go step by step. And I hope you'll be able to understand what I say better. So let's say we postpone that topic for the time being.
Well, maybe I could ask another question then. When you started speaking, you were sort of talking about what it's possible to say about art. What, in other words, like what's within the realm of reasonable discourse, and is it only judgments of quality that are reasonable to speak of to address art or
no
to talk about?
No.
Like what other kinds of things do you think are valid ways of speaking about art? You mentioned like physical properties and wavelengths of light. Do you think that that's at all valuable in considering a work of art?
I think when I used the word tentative, I meant, for example, in describing a work of art, whether it's a poem or a piece of music or a painting or a sculpture, the description should know itself as tentative, not exhaustive. And maybe the emphasis in the given description is not the hard and fast or fixed emphasis. You can take a painting by Titian and describe it relevantly, as I feel, in a dozen different ways, maybe in an infinite number of ways. And always with a certain tentativeness, because we don't know whether we're actually describing the picture as a work of art or as something else. We may be describing it as a physical object. We may be describing it as a document. We may be describing it as a symptom of Titian's state of mind or psychology, and so on and so on. Now, I should give you examples, but I didn't come here prepared with them. You can go to almost any book about painting or about sculpture, that deals with specific works, or for that matter books on music or literature that deal with specific works, and find examples of what I mean. You can describe a novel by giving a synopsis of its plot, and there you're not sure the emphasis is right. If you synopsize War and Peace, you may have the feeling you're beside the point about War and Peace as a work of art. if you give quick rundowns of the characters in War and Peace, you may still feel you're beside the point. And again, I'm approaching something I want to handle later, which is why a work of art eludes discourse the way a little pellet of mercury would. You can't get it quite under your finger. Not with words. And I'll anticipate myself and say, repeat what's been said by other people, and quite rightly, that in the end, a work of art boils down to relationships, relations, not relationship. Everything becomes what's called relational. In this, as the work of art eludes each description or characterization you want to try to pin it down with. And when it comes to quality, this becomes more evident than ever.
You talk about art for art's sake, and I would challenge that to this degree that I don't think that morality and aesthetics can be separated at a time when civilization itself is threatened. And that implicit in art for art's sake is the denial of the responsibility of the artist to civilization itself when civilization is being threatened by militarization and obliteration, when the militarization of society is a cultural and aesthetic fact, and a destructive aesthetic fact.
Yeah, I have an embarrassing answer to that. Just as we don't ask a shoemaker to put himself in touch with the most burning issues of the day in making shoes, we don't ask an artist in making art to put himself in relation with the most important issues of the day. And as I said before, this doesn't mean that art is just as important as what human beings do to one another. I only repeat that when you're at art, when you're making art, it's art you're making as an end in itself, and it's art you're dealing with as an end in itself. And it is rather simple, and I think St. Thomas Aquinas was the first one to say something like it. The shoemaker making his shoe, of course, shoe is a means of something else, but the shoemaker has to make a good shoe. First of all, if he's a good shoemaker, if he is to, let's say, fulfill the demands, the justified demands that society makes on him. And it is, I think, as simple as that. Which doesn't mean that the artist as a human being away from his art has to turn his back on politics or morality. It doesn't follow at all from art for art's sake. What did happen to the slogan art for art's sake in the 19th century was it shifted over into the assertion that art was more important than anything else, which I feel is a very illegitimate, immoral assertion.
Isn't the future of art dependent upon the future of civilization?
Most certainly. Well, let the artist, when he's away from his art, show his solicitude about civilization. Ellie?
Do you think there's a, similarly as the craftsman or the shoemaker is preoccupied with making just a good shoe, what exactly is the artist concerned with making a good work of art? That is it a historical issue, how he relates in a historical sense to...
That's a big, big question. Come on, let's not get to that. We know damn well that the artist is preoccupied with something far tougher than making, than
a
craft.
Well, I didn't try to make it too fun.
No, when I liken the two, I'm taking for granted that everybody here appreciates the enormous difference.
Yeah.
I don't think we have to go into what makes art different from craft. Not at this point, anyhow. Yeah.